Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to get to depart from the worlds of politics and law, which I cover on television, to talk about the beloved and passionate world of theater here at WGNRadio.com and the podcast Behind the Curtain. What an honor it is today to talk to somebody who you want to talk about as being a kind of pioneer in modern day theater and having an imprint in theater that will last for generations to come. Say hi to my next guest, Gail Papp. Is a name in her own right, but also the widow of Joseph Papp, who, of course, began the public theater years ago. We're going to get that whole story from her. And it's all now memorialized in a book called Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. If you are a theater fan, you go to New York, you know exactly what the public theater is all about. Gail, it's an honor to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here with you.
So, look. A lot of theater people listen and watch this podcast. They can see us as well. And, you know, not everybody has great history with it. So I need you to explain for the uninformed, if you would, a little bit about the public theater and its mission, because it's always had a very special mission. And it goes back to Joe's goals.
OK, I'd be very happy to do that. The public theater is, first of all, it's a complex of five theaters and a pub that's in Greenwich Village. In New York, it's in one building. They're all very small venues. Our largest theater is 299 seats. It goes down to 99 seats and other stages in between in size. It was founded in 1967 by Joe as a place to do new American work. And at that time in the 60s, to devote a big space such as this building that he acquired for that purpose was considered amazing. There were new plays being done here and there, but they were kind of in basements or in old church stages. But nobody was devoting a whole building to this kind of enterprise. So it was really quite new. We opened with our first show there. With the very first and original production of Hair, the musical,
yes.
Which got developed in a kind of a, I would call it a somewhat chaotic fashion at our place. We only had one theater then. We hadn't built the others. So Hair was what opened this new enterprise of Joe's. He had been very active in the theater before that in New York City, doing Shakespeare in the city's parks for free, not charging admission. So he done it different places around the city. And then he was able to build a 2,000 seat amphitheater in New York City's Central Park, although it was opposed at first because people didn't like that idea too much of free admission. But he got that established. It's been going strong ever since. He believed passionately that the arts should be accessible to the public in New York City, as well as elsewhere. When he opened the public theater, which is around the time that I came on the scene, this is back in 1965, it's way back then, I was hired as a temporary summer worker at the outdoor theater. And then I stayed on when he decided to establish the public theater. So I was there
for a long time.
Yeah. So I saw this transition from, you know, Shakespeare free outdoors to new works indoors downtown for minimal charge of $2.50. And it was devoted to new works by writers that at that time in that era had been previously ignored and not produced because of their ethnicity or whatever, and gender also. So he was quite devoted passionately to that kind of enterprise. And it was not a good business model. If you have a building full of eventually six tiny theaters by Broadway standards, they're all exceedingly small. There's no way as a business model you're going to make money to support that enterprise. You have then, as a nonprofit organization, to raise all the money to produce the plays in that kind of building. And so that's what he started to do. And there have been many really amazing works that have been done there.
For people who don't know the Public Theater, they might say, oh, they probably just done some shows we've never heard of. Well, you already mentioned Hair. I recently interviewed Ben Vereen, so we had some memories to share about that show. But in case people are wondering, and correct me if I get any of these wrong, but Chorus Line, Angels in America, Hamilton, and most recently, Here Lies Love.
Right, exactly.
And I could go on. Mystery of Edwin Drood, which my friend Greg Edelman was in. Right. I just have to ask you what, and Cheetah Rivera and so many others, but I have to ask you what is it that led you, and you were a script reader at a point in your career, right?
I had done some script reading, and then as I stayed on at the Public Theater, I became in charge of the department that developed new work, new plays, and new music.
And that's what I wanted to ask you. How is it, and I'm sure not every play you ever put up there was a raging hit, but, you know, when I look at and Normal Heart, let me not forget Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart. Right. What was it about a play that you and Joe would watch and say, we're putting this one up? And then it was like magic.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I've struggled to answer it various times. You just have to go by your own feeling and your own taste, your own passions, and rely on that. It's exceedingly fallible and imperfect. I can't defend it on any kind of objective grounds, except as you have more experience in the theater, I think you can recognize certain things that might come together for a good production. If you have some kind of instinct or feeling for talent in others, I think that helps. Joe Papp certainly had that. He could recognize talent whenever he encountered it. Instantly, he had a great, great feeling for it.
When you say talent, most people watching us are thinking, well, she means the star. Because, by the way, let me also toss in Denzel Washington. And this, I could keep going. I could go on forever with who's been there. But here's the question. Did talent to Joe and you, I want to include you in this. You were married, and I know you had a lot of input throughout this. Was the talent in the actors, the directors, the Michael Bennett's of the world, the talent, or was it the whole package?
Well, nothing came as a whole package, really, that I can remember. Although Michael Bennett, whom we mentioned, certainly brought in this amazing coterie of hugely talented people in the performing arts, but who were already pretty well established and recognized, like Marvin Hamlisch or Ed Kleban. But the recognition of talent is something that I think most people can understand, because if you go to see something, and let's say in a production with 25 people, there's one person that you can't take your eyes off of, because you find them so fascinating, their presence on stage, where they move, where they talk, whatever it is that just, you know, makes you pay attention and interests you, that person has some kind of performing talent. I'm talking about performers now. You know whether you are paying attention that way or not. I mean, you don't be told, oh, you should pay attention. You know you have that kind of interest. That's a recognition of talent in that person, that they have this ability to draw you in and draw your eyes to them on stage.
Denzel.
Exactly. Denzel Washington. Any of the people, many people like Denzel Washington got their start, you know, early on in their careers. I could name, you know, James Earl Jones is a very young man. Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep also. Many, many people. Raul Julia, the wonderful Raul Julia. So they had this kind of talent. You could not take your eyes off of them. When it comes to the writers or composers, I'll take composers first. Someone like Rupert Holmes, for instance, whom I got to know quite well. He's also a mystery writer, like yourself, right?
Yes, I am. And, yes.
Yes. And he
You've done your homework. How about that?
He wrote this marvelous book, which I read. He sent me an early proof of it last year, called Murder Your Employers. So it's a marvelous mystery book in his inimitable fashion. So when he came in with his idea for, he'd never done a musical before, And I went to see him sing, and I knew he did wonderful songs and so forth, and the lyrics were really good. And I saw him perform, and I left a little note for him at the door of this club where he was singing in New York City. And I said, "Are you interested in theater by any chance? So please call me." He called me the next day, and he had this idea for a mystery musical, right, based on Dickens' unfinished last novel called The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which is a mystery story. Dickens was then in competition with other people writing mysteries, so he decided he'd do one. But he died before he finished it. So Rupert had this marvelous idea of presenting it as a music hall entertainment based on the book with the characters, and that it would be unfinished, kind of like the book that Dickens wrote, but he would provide the audience with the opportunity of voting on the ending of the story. And he wrote, I think, five different endings, both in terms of plot and the music involved. And everybody was rehearsed in the five different endings, which would end differently every single night that this musical was performed, depending on how the audience voted. So it was like a free-for-all. You never knew how it was going to end the night you were there. It was just his execution of this marvelous idea was just marvelous.
And no wonder, by the way, it won Tony for Best Musical. I was there. I was in one of those audiences. As I said, my friend Greg Edelman was in it. And, of course, Stephanie J. Block and Cheetah Rivera. And, you know, what names.
Rupert's accomplishment. It was just extraordinary to me. I compared it in a book I've written to Venus arriving fully formed on a half shell in one of those illustrations. It just arrived fully formed. He thought about it for a lot of years. And as he began to compose it, he would send me these tapes, you know, the old cassette tapes of yesteryear. And I would hear these marvelous songs he'd sing on his piano and record and send to me. And they were just amazing. It was really so well conceived and so well executed out of his amazing talent, which was multifaceted. And this musical, by the way, was, I think, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, possibly unique in the history of the American musical, in that he wrote the book, he wrote the lyrics, he wrote the music, he wrote the songs, and he wrote the orchestrations also, all of those things, which are usually separated in the musical theater amongst kinds of talented people in those categories. He did all of that himself. He didn't have any collaborators. He didn't need them, which is just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah, we think of people like Lin-Manuel Miranda or others who can do several of those things, but they still need collaborators to do it. Probably even Barry Manilow and Harmony. I mean, they still need collaborators to do what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Did you guys have, so I want to talk about the Normal Heart for a moment. I had the rare treat to meet Larry Kramer back when the show played in Chicago. And here's the thing. When you write about that show, you talk about it as being initially 4 hours long, jumbled themes, the gay brother, the straight brother, and all of that. Right. How much, if any, of a role did you play in the development of a show? And I picked Normal Heart because that's probably one that underwent significant development.
It sure did. Larry, he'd had very bad experience with it, shopping it around. And he had this urgency about it because it was in the midst of the horrible AIDS plague when nobody was paying any attention to it. So he felt it had to get out there. He wanted to bring attention to it through the play. So he had poured a lot into the play, which was huge amounts of statistics about AIDS, medical statistics, which were not really performable in a sense, a dramatic sense, but they were in the script anyhow. And then he had a very urgent story about his straight brother, his relationship to an older straight brother, which was real, a real story. And so he was very dedicated to having that fully put forth. But the essence of the play was about his being on this founding organization of gay representatives to try to deal with the ignoring of the AIDS epidemic. And then the fact that he had a combative nature in public regarding that issue, he disaffected some of them because they felt he was imperiling the organization. And so they dismissed him from the founding board. So his play was in the aftermath of that. And there's little bits of that realistic, real-time experience that he'd had in the play. I didn't know anything about that experience that he'd had. So in a way, that was a blessing because I couldn't read, real people into these characters. Mm. So when he came to me with the play, very angry about its dismissal in other quarters in the theater, apparently, he was very anxious to have it done immediately. At first, he was angry because Joe didn't read it right off the bat. Well, you know, it was 400 pages long. I kid you not. I mean, that's very long.
Yeah.
I don't know if you tried to perform.
Well, it was 4 hours long, so that's 100 hours a page, right? About 100 pages an hour.
Yeah, if you tried to perform a 400-page
work. Was there something about the AIDS theme? And, of course, sadly, Kramer eventually died of AIDS himself. But also Angels in America and Steven Spinelli and the folks who were involved in that show. Was there something about – I'm thinking of so many of these shows – even Chorus Line in a very different way, which tackled issues that had never been tackled before. It might have even been one of the first shows with swear words in it. And I remember as a little kid, I was like playing the album a million times, having my parents listen to what they're saying. But what was it always about trying to break new ground as you were doing shows, which so many of those did? And let me toss in one more. Lin-Manuel's Hamilton, the notion of casting, you know, Hamilton as Latino or George Washington as African American. I mean, just turning theater on its head.
Right. Well, this is what the writers come up with. So it's in terms of the producing aspect, it's what you respond to in writers and the work that they present and have in mind. So Joe was responsive to certain kinds of writers that presented this kind of work to him. And it's true today. You mentioned Hamilton, which is, of course, post-Joe, but it's the theater that he founded in Oscar Eustace, who's now the artistic director, but certainly feels the DNA of the organization.
And Louise Miranda, who sits on your board, by the way.
Yeah, she's the chairman of our board, as a matter of fact. Yeah. And so that DNA of the original passion that Joe had for neglected people, or people not being paid attention to enough, who were talented and had something to say, is certainly there still. And it was always part of Joe's role as a producer. He certainly wasn't in the theater as a producer to make money, because he never did make money in the theater. Other people had hits that moved to Broadway, did. Joe was in it for, I think, the satisfaction he got in what he did, which was to produce certain kinds of work. He got a satisfaction from the success of those works, and they're reaching the public. That meant a great deal to him. He had kind of the soul of an artist himself.
Yeah.
But you think, well, a producer is the guy that raises money. You know, he sits back and things happen and so forth. Joe wasn't like that. He was very involved. He was very available. He was very good in helping writers understand their work. And if he got behind it, he really tried to make it happen in the best way possible.
And, you know, when I think about the pandemic we all just lived through, if you think about it, the group that took it the hardest on the chin, arguably, was the theater world and the performers and the actors who were out of work. And yet, who was the first group to put on the benefits and raise money and do everything they could to help? It's the people who needed the money most themselves. And I've always contributed to those causes. There's no better world than the world of theater and acting. I do want to ask you, you were married to Joe for 26 years.
I was with him for 26 years.
I mean, if you want to know about the public theater and the history and all these shows we're talking about, it's all in the book. But I found the book to also be a love story, a testament to Joe. And here's my first question. Somebody who's going to watch this interview is a local PR artist here in Chicago, PR talent here in Chicago named Kathy Taylor. And when I told her I was going to talk to you, she said, I did my master's thesis on Joe Papp and the public theater.
My.
So she can't wait to watch this. I thought I'd let you know that. But at the same time, I wanted to ask you something that maybe Kathy and all her research in graduate school would have never found. Today, she's one of the best PR artists, PR people here. Can you tell us something about Joe that somebody who's researching him wouldn't have found and wouldn't know?
Well, you know, the research possibilities and facilities are like other works, maybe theses or something that have been written about Joe. There are two other very fine books that have been written about him. One is a culturally oriented biography by Helen Epstein, who's a wonderful writer. And the other is something he originally collaborated with, which is an oral history by Kenneth Turan. Those are both very fine books.
But you were married to him.
Yeah. But mine is a first personal memoir, which is different. It's a different kind of book. They all, I think, complement each other because history is a woven fabric of different accounts from different people who have different experiences of the same events and the same people. So given that, that's my view of history. There's room for all of it. And I think that in terms of the research that a person can do, it's limited to the public record, right? And maybe some interviews with those still alive that, you know, have an experience.
That's why I've given you the question. I mean, more so than anybody doing research.
Well, I think what people don't get from, say, the public record and many descriptions of Joe is what a deep feeling and reflective person he was, because his public persona was often described as arrogant, aggressive, whatever you call those kind of words. It went on forever. And he was that way in some circumstances, but my experience, my life with Joe was a very different kind of person. He was deeply reflective. He was very philosophical. He was funny. He was a delight to be with. He was not grim in any way whatsoever. He was not a congenitally angry person in his personal style with friends and family. He was very balanced and circumspect in many ways when he dealt with problems. And but he was also at the same time very passionate, a passionate person who truly cared what he was doing in his life. And
is that what drew you to him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was just fascinated when I first started working at the public theater, and it was also called the New York Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah,
I was just fascinated by his idea of a democratic access to theater, and then a democratic conduct of a theater in terms of its opportunities for all artists, regardless of ethnicity or gender and so forth. Well, you know, I grew up as a young girl in the horrible decade of the 1950s, when I remember applying as a past teenage for a trainee job in editorial work. Well, I came from a family of editors. I knew a little bit about it. But so I appeared for an interview, and I was rejected on site by the personnel manager because I was a female. And this job had been listed in the New York Times under help wanted male, because the jobs were segregated by gender in my day. And if you accidentally showed up for a trainee job under M for male and you were a female, you were rejected on site, as I was.
Wow.
So I understood from that, you know, what any kind of prejudice of that sort, no matter what it is, feels like. And it gave me a very good base for understanding other people's feelings of automatic rejection because of those factors. And I thought, this is crazy. I mean, it's outrageous. It's insane. It was just the beginning of the women's liberation movement. So I was just getting introduced to some of that. And it was very instructive, although it outraged me at the time. But it gave me a very good base for understanding other people's outrage and resentment that came through in what they would write and perform in the theater. I understood that from a very deep base in myself, having gone through that kind of experience, which I could translate into other situations and other people's lives. It gave me a tremendous feeling of identification with a very important play that I just loved called For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Was Enough by Antozake Shange, a wonderful poet and a fantastic dramatist. I identified so much with that work. It was really kind of puzzling to me at first because she writes about her own experience as a Black woman, none of which was similar to anything I had ever experienced or been through. But I identified it very strongly with it. For one thing, with the magnificent poetry. He was a great poet. And she became a very dear friend of mine as a result of our association in that play. And my feelings about it, I think, were available to me because of what I'd been through, even though it was totally different, a different cultural world and a different experience entirely. But I could understand what she was talking about, even though I had no experience similar to hers. There was a kind of a universal connection. And it was a great gift from my early turmoil of being rejected and so forth and so on. It was a gift.
When you and Joe weren't talking theater, which I had to consume so much of your lives and time, I'm right. guessing, you don't quite say this in the book, but I'm guessing you spent a lot of time talking about politics, whether you're love or hate for it, but there had to be a lot of politics talk.
Well, there was. There certainly was. There were, inevitably, there were things that, you know, we ran into.
Did that influence the decisions? I mean, I'm not asking for your politics, but did that influence your decisions in terms of the shows that you wanted to do, that you wanted the public to put on based on what was going on in society? I'm thinking of the AIDS shows, things like that, where there was a message that had to get out.
Right. But you have to understand that in the producing aspect, the creative producing aspect of a theater, unless you put out a call for something, I want shows that deal with this or that subject, you are essentially being guided by what comes to you or what you can find and encourage coming to you. You're not the creator of it. You can be very responsive to the creator, but you are not yourself the creator of those particular subjects and ideas and plays. They come from the people who are writing them.
Those playwrights have to decide where to go first. I'm curious, was Joe, maybe early on in his career, your career with him, you know, maybe early on people went other places first, but I can't. I mean, the public is just so legendary to me that I feel as though at some point, you're right, people have to come to you. But I'm thinking to myself, and that's exactly what they did. They wanted to go talk to Joe Papp.
Yes, they did. I remember when we first opened, plays started coming in all of a sudden, a lot of plays. And our first seasons were an amazing number of plays by Black writers who hadn't been able to find any kind of open door or opportunity elsewhere in the whole country, only here and there, little dips and dabs. So Joe, I think in our first 2 years, produced plays by 10 Black writers and also the first Black writers to win the Pulitzer Prize was Charles Gordone.
And I think you guys do Bring Into Noise, Bring Into Funk?
And it was no Place to Be Somebody. It was just way back.
You did do the other one later.
It was just one of my favorite shows of all time. George Wolfe's amazing.
Yes.
I was just on a Joe's Pub discussion with George. We always enjoy each other's company so much because he just makes me laugh all the time. He's an amazing guy. He's so brilliant. And he just has this marvelous film out about Rustin, Bayard Rustin, the civil rights organizer. So George is responsible for that show. And he became the artistic director at one point for 10 years at the public.
1993 to 2005.
Absolutely. And it was a brilliant decade of his leadership there. Just absolutely wonderful. So he was an important person who knew Joe, whom Joe had clearly thought of as a successor to him when he was having to think those things because of his illness in the last year of his life. George was clearly in his mind in that role, although I don't know whether George thought of himself that way, but Joe certainly did, because he recognized the talent and the passion and the kind of ability to take risks, which Joe always did.
As a producer, you had to deal with what was going on in the economy and society as a whole. Joe is not here, obviously, for the pandemic we just lived through. And coming out of the pandemic, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's fair to say that while maybe big theaters and stuff are wondering how they can regain their profit, when I think of not-profit theaters or the public theater, I thought the issue you had to face was just, how do you survive?
Yeah.
And what would Joe have been, what would Joe have suggested to the current team of the public theater coming out of the pandemic to do, or would he have been proud of the way it's all been handled? Because you certainly are surviving.
Well, I think every theater, big, middle, or small, is having tremendous problem now because
Chicago too.
As you know, the pandemic is, the audiences don't want to go into closed spaces anymore. They got used to streaming, etc. Even on good movies is so much. And there's also been this huge racial reckoning upheaval at the same time, and so forth. So it's really a tremendous challenge, and the donor money supply is not as fluid or significant as it used to be. All these things coming together, it's a real crunch. And how do you deal with it? How would Joe deal with it?
Would he have cut back on the season? Would, you know, and those are some decisions that theaters are making today.
I don't know exactly what Joe would do. I think if it required measures that some theaters have taken, he would doubtless do some of them. Because if you're looking to the survival of an organization that doesn't have the income anymore and doesn't have the audiences coming anymore, what do you do in the face of that kind of thing? I can't really tell you exactly what I think he would do.
As time goes on, and I know you're in touch with the theater world and stuff, but I guess I'm thinking, you know, 10 years from now, 20, 30 years from now, to me, Joe Papp, the public theater, is just a foundation of theatrical history. Do you feel that the public theater and the work of Joe, and again, I always include you because you're married for so long, but with him for so long, but do you will the theater world and community look back, and how will they look back on the Joe Papp and public theater experience, and what has theater learned from the public theater?
Well, I think many of the things that he initiated, such as the free Shakespeare in the parks has been done elsewhere. So there is a kind of influence that's been emulated elsewhere and taken a hold. I've talked to several other people that had very significant experiences elsewhere in the country with the free Shakespeare in their parks.
We do that in Chicago.
Yeah. right. So I think there's that kind of influence. I think there's something that it trickles down in terms of what originates from the theater. You mentioned Hamilton and current days. It certainly has an impact. And the fact, whether people know it or not, where it comes from or what the history of that is, it conveys certain aspects of what the public theater stood for and stands for continuing to today. So it has an influence. The influence continues. Whether people are informed about its history and origins or not may be open to question, but it certainly exerts an interest. And
but it also sounds like he lives on and you all live on through people like Lin-Manuel Miranda, people who share the values, share the purpose, and carry on to the next generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It does carry on. It, in some interesting, kind of mystical way in my mind, what Joe started and what he represented became embedded in the DNA of his theater. People that work there now, they all kind of know about that. We have something in our program, actually, that tells, started this year, and this is Joe Papp's thing. So you can inform yourself a little bit about that. But, the fact of what the theater represents, and it now has, five theaters plus the pub functioning, Somehow the nature of that is kind of trickled down. It's not always easy to pinpoint it because there's also a kind of entrepreneurial, nonprofit entrepreneurial aspect to the theater in that it wants to succeed in reaching audiences. And it's had a remarkable record in reaching Broadway audiences and the whole commercial area, which is, you know, been worked out, so it's satisfactorily done.
And I would argue teaching audiences and letting them succeed in that way is what the theater is all about. I want to be sure that I properly thank you. Your work, Joe's work, it just obviously you can see it's impacted me and through all these years. And I think it's amazing. The book is public, private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. I would hold it up at the green screen. We'll block it by Gail Merrifield Papp. It's available where better books are sold and on Amazon as well. God bless you. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you're around for another 80 years.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It really has.
Be well.
Enjoyed it. You too.